Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing awareness that Donald Trump is dangerously unqualified to be president and that he is neither stable nor competent, as Republican Senator Bob Corker suggested. Yet he is wildly popular with 80% of the Republican voters. Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joins us to discuss the tribal division in America between those inside government who have dealt with this deluded and possibly deranged individual in the Oval Office and the 65% of Americans who are beginning to understand the deeply embarrassing and frightening nature of this electoral aberration. While on the other side, 35% of the country are happy with the economy and love what Trump is doing, trashing the press and praising the Confederacy. And now since Stephen Bannon has his hands back on his Breitbart weapons, we can expect the country to be further polarized by right-wing radicals who see themselves at war with the Marxist liberal establishment, globalists, and cosmopolitans. Then, with Trump ignoring the 40,000 overwhelmingly peaceful marchers in Boston yesterday protesting a gathering of about 100 neo-Nazis, as he tweeted out, "looks like many anti-police agitators in Boston," we will examine the role of the remaining white supremacists and fascist sympathizers in the White House, Sebastian Gorka and his wife, Catherine, who apparently influences Trump's thinking and have managed to curtail Homeland Security's efforts to monitor white supremacist domestic terrorists in the country. David Shanza, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, joins us to discuss the Trump administration's willful blindness towards who is responsible by far for most of the domestic terrorism in America. Then finally, we look into the use of vehicles as instruments of terrorism, both in Charlottesville and Barcelona, and speak with Mia Bloom, an expert on terrorism at Georgia State University and the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, and the forthcoming Small Arms, Children and Terror. She joins us to discuss the teenage terrorist involved in the Barcelona massacre and the different approach Spanish authorities take towards their Muslim communities, as opposed to the Trump administration's demonization of whole communities who now no longer feel they can cooperate with local police. And joining us now is Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine, and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Thank you.
And many commentators are suggesting that the strange behavior of Donald Trump in the foyer of Trump Tower last Tuesday really revealed who Donald Trump is in private and in White House meetings, and that the few adults in the room have to spend their time trying to disabuse Donald Trump of these strange ideas he gets from Fox News, from Breitbart, and from Alex Jones. And furthermore, they're suggesting that this moment could be compared to the Access Hollywood tape moment back during the campaign when the true nature of Donald Trump's attitudes toward women was revealed. But of course, the lesson there is that he survived Access Hollywood. So do you think he's going to survive this current kind of awakening going on as to who this man really is in the Oval Office?
Well, I think we've got a couple of questions there wrapped into one, Ian. One question is, will he survive in terms of getting anything through Congress? And there, I think the answer is no. I think Congress has really woken up to the true nature of this person. I don't know why it took them so long, but I think power obscured a lot of Republicans' views of him, and now it's become clear that he has no loyalty. So, and that he's not a capable, sane man. And so I think within Congress, you're going to start seeing a huge break very quickly, and you're already seeing that. Within the idea of him getting impeached or being forced out of office, That's a trickier thing, and there you have to do the math, and I don't see the math working right now. I'm not sure if this is the moment where that might happen. And then the third question is whether the American people start turning against him. And here, I think we've got a real issue. You've got a lot of the American people, of course, who were never for him. You have a subset who voted for him for other reasons. You know, they were hoping to get a Supreme Court justice, which they got, or they were hoping that he would advance a more regular conservative Republican agenda, which they're probably not going to get. But then you have a hardcore of people who have been waiting to hear this sort of thing for a long time. Maybe they've never voted before. Maybe they've always felt this way. And finally, they have someone speaking for them. And the more he is unleashed, the more that tribal identity, I think, comes out. And the way that the left has been going about saying that this man is unhinged doesn't help, because then those people see us as attacking them. So I think you won't see much of his agenda getting through. I also don't think you'll see him impeached. And I think the longer he's in office, the more that group of about 35% of the voting public of America, which of course is not 35% of America as a whole, doubles down and sticks with him.
And is this likely to be exacerbated now that Stephen Bannon has left the White House and it's just now he's got his hands back on his weapons at Breitbart and he's ready to go to war? And I must say, this notion of war is used quite a lot by the radical right in this country, who really do believe that there is a kind of Marxist liberal establishment of globalists and cosmopolitans.
Well, not just by the radical right. Of course, you've probably seen the NRA's latest fundraising videos, which also bring up these ideas of culture wars, but they walk very quickly to turning a culture war into a law and order war and then into something that you approach with arms. Yeah, I think that it's worrisome that Breitbart is now going to be reinvigorated by Bannon. Now, whether Bannon is friendly with Trump or angry with Trump or pushes further than Trump, it's hard to know. I was just crunching the numbers, actually. I was just looking at the data on the Republican Party. And one thing that you see when you look at that data on voting behavior is that the base of the party is actually far more radical than the party itself. So you have this base that's just running to the far right, and the party just can't keep up. So as much as the party seems to be moving right, which they are, if you measure, there's a database called DW Nominate that looks at scores of how conservative members are voting. They're moving, the Republican Party is definitely moving to the right based on those scores, but their base is outrunning them. And it's because of things like Breitbart and Fox that are pulling further and further to the right. And it's hard to know how much further we can go and remain a democracy.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security and governance. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine, and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Well, not only is Stephen Bannon promising to inflame the divisions already in this country, and much of the commentary going on since this Charlottesville tragedy has been a criticism of our president, who is not a uniter but a divider, and the point's been made many times that other presidents, previous presidents at a time of tragedy, have tried to heal the nation, whereas Donald Trump seems to be throwing fires on the flames of division. But he will do so even more, I believe, this coming Tuesday in Arizona, where he's down there possibly to pardon Sheriff Joe Arpaio and certainly to hurt the re-election chances of fellow Republican Senator Jeff Flake.
You're absolutely right, and I think Jeff Flake is a great example. I mean, I'm a Democrat, and I'm not a fan of Jeff Flake. He's an extreme conservative. He sees himself as the heir to Barry Goldwater. But he's a conservative who believes in the principles of conservatism, and I can respect that. And he's come out, as you know, with this book saying that not only has Trump taken over his party in this sort of hostile takeover, but the party has allowed him to do it. So that has meant it's not nearly as hostile, and that the party has given up its conservatism for power. And so I think we're starting to see what happens when one party does that. And it's, I study democracy all around the world, and I think what we're moving toward is something quite dangerous. Democracies do fall apart. You do see them. We've seen it a number of times in Latin America. We're seeing it now in Poland and Hungary. Philippines. You can see democracies vote people in who reduce the worth of the institutions and reduce the friendliness between the people, so that people so dislike one another that it's impossible to do anything that brings the nation together. And then the country can really devolve into violence and into poverty and things like that. And we might be headed for that.
So is there, I find it pretty conspicuous, for example, that the religious right is certainly not coming out to condemn Trump, and I find it extraordinary that the leader of the Jewish state of Israel, Netanyahu, has not really had any kind of full-throated criticism of Trump's making excuses for neo-Nazis. Is that debate simply gone into this polarization, this tribalism? I mean, a part of me thinks that one of the reasons why so many of Trump's supporters, as you see them now being polled and being asked on television about their continuing support for Trump, and at the Iowa State Fair, they're all, praising Trump. Is it a part of it, the reason that they make excuses for Trump's peculiar dalliance with the white supremacist, is this notion of equal time that we have in our media, that in the universe of discourse is two equal and opposite opinions always, and therefore Trump is all he's saying to them, it's there's a problem on both sides, there's violence on both sides. Is that what informs that that lack of proportionality in the at least that big chunk of the American public that supports Trump?
So I think two things are going on here, and they're interlinked, but they're separable, and it's important to separate them. One is that the left and the right of America are polarized to a degree that they haven't been since the 1890s. So the last time we saw this level of separation between the left and right was the 1890s, and we can talk about how that got healed, but it wasn't pretty. The other thing that's going on is a polarization between the elites and the non-elites. And that is something that both parties are guilty of. Both parties have been pushing economic policies that help the rich get richer. Both parties have been helping and listening to people of the upper middle class rather than the people on the bottom. The Democrats tend to listen to the people on the very bottom and at the top, and the Republicans tend to listen to people at the top and near the top. But your kind of working class, lower class folks have not gotten heard for a long time, and they're angry. And they've been angry really since Reagan. They had hope under him for a while, and then it started to dissipate under a more status quo Republican Party. So you put those two things together, and you have a group of people who have leaned right for a long time, but who haven't been listened to by the right, who now feel that they've got a full-throated supporter in the White House, and they're reveling in finally having someone who feels the things that they feel and who will voice things that they'll voice. And it has as much to do with class, but by which I mean what they watch, what they listen to, not by how much money they have, but a whole series of identity markers, as it does with left and right. But those two things play into each other. And so you've had a right-wing radio and media world that for a long time has said that the left-wing media can't be trusted. And these folks have listened to that for a long time, and now they've put that together with Trump, and they've kind of reaped what they've sowed.
Well, when you refer to the 1890s, of course, the previous Gilded Age, and many suggest that we are in another Gilded Age, and we certainly do have money-driven politics. And I believe during the McKinley versus William Jennings Bryan's race, the Republicans outspent the Democrats something like 80-1. But of course, back then, William Jennings Bryan was a member of what you could call the religious left. But now we have a religious right dominating Republican politics. And given the money-driven nature of our politics, it does seem that you've got, it's the right-wing plutocrats like Mercer and Koch. The Koch brothers clearly have a lot of influence over the Congress and of getting their way with what little the Congress has achieved. And the Mercers seem to have tremendous influence over Trump. He just, Mercer met with Stephen Bannon on Wednesday last week for several hours, and then on Thursday had dinner with Donald Trump. So we don't really know the true nature of Bannon's exit and what their plans are. And, of course, Mercer's going to put up a lot of money to defeat Jeff Flake. So are we in a situation where you have basically their plutocrats versus our plutocrats?
In certain ways, and I think that's why I think the 1890s comparison is so important and why the inequality issues play so much into today's world, because the Republican, any party, any political party controls its message and its messengers through controlling get out the vote, through controlling money, through controlling media, and through controlling data. And the Republican Party basically outsourced all of those things. So they have a media machine that they don't really control. These plutocrats on the Republican side both fund candidates to a very strong extent, but also after Citizens United, they fund super PACs and so on that have far more money than the party. Koch and a number of the other leading Republican donors have get-out-the-vote efforts themselves, and they can work with the evangelical churches, which also have get-out-the-vote efforts. So what you see on the Republican side is a party that actually has very little control over its message or messengers, and these major, major money donors who have a lot more control. And those individuals want certain things. Now, I don't know the top people personally, I must say, on the Republican side. I know what I've heard about them, but I don't know them personally, so I can't speak to what they want. But I can speak to the amount of fear they've spread through the right. I just spent all last week actually meeting with Republicans and conservatives who were never Trumpers of one sort or another, and they are terrified by the amount of money, because that money basically means that if they speak out loudly, they lose their jobs. They lose their ability to keep working in conservative think tanks. They lose their ability to keep working for conservative members of the Hill. They have to find new careers at mid-career. And so that money is silencing a lot of people on the right who don't like this man, but have kids in college or have other things that they're thinking about and can't afford to lose their jobs.
So do you think, though, that on the Democratic side there's too much sort of wishful thinking about impeachment and that rather than come up with a new narrative and new candidates and a movement, which is, I think, is inchoate and out there. After all, the day after Trump's inauguration, millions of women showed up to vote. And by the way, 40,000 people marched yesterday in Boston, and there were like about 100 neo-Nazis cowering in a rotunda. So the numbers are out there. So my sense is that there's a huge problem here with the Democrats getting their act together, because too many are relying on this idea that this guy's going to get impeached or he's going to quit in a huff.
Well, I agree with you, and I actually think that the Democrats, in a way, have just as big a problem as the Republicans, but it's harder to deal with. The Republican Party has imploded. It's been subject to this semi-hostile, semi-accepted takeover. And so the real conservatives are trying desperately to take back their party. But I think the more Trump unmasks himself, the easier that will be. On the Democratic side, because everything Trump does plays to Democrats getting more people out, they think they can be a little more sanguine. But the reality is, everybody is going to be running for president in 3.5 years. You're going to see any Democrat coming out of the woodwork to run. That could actually be a problem. It could be hard to unite behind someone. And if you look at the numbers on the Democrats, I was looking at both sides when I was crunching those numbers, Democrats are also to the left of their party more and more. So in 95, I believe it was, about 27% of Democrats identified as liberal. Now it's 41%. So it's still not the majority, but you're getting more and more Democrats saying, we're on the Elizabeth Warren progressive wing. And that is not necessarily what would win in a general election, but it's where the energy is in the party. So both parties have trouble, and I think both parties need to remake messages that were basically left over from the 20th century. I mean, this was, both parties existed in a world in which Russia was the bad guy, in which America was on top. We were the major power in the world. We could set the tone in the world. After the last three presidents, and I do think all three of them played a role in this, we can't do that anymore. And we're in a different world. And the parties need to recognize that and need to be able to address both the technological changes and the global changes that are causing economic issues here at home and issues of pride and power here at home to change. Democrats are not doing that very well. I don't think they're, what was it called, the New Deal? The better deal. I can't remember the adjective. But, you know, the fact that I don't know it when I'm part of that, you know, pretty deeply part of that party is a problem.
Well, Dr. Rensch Kleinfeld, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and named one of the top 40 under 40 political leaders by Time magazine, and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the Trump administration's willful blindness towards white supremacists responsible for most of the domestic terrorism in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Shanzer, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Stanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as counsel to Senator Joseph Biden and counsel to Senator William Cohen, and worked in the executive branch as a special counsel to the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Defense and as a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanzer.
Well, thank you for having me.
And can you fill us in a little on what seems to be going on here in the sense that my understanding is that the kind of people that showed up in Charlottesville and the terrorism coming from that quarter, from white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and militia people on the far right, is by far the greatest problem in terms of domestic terrorism. I mean, I believe it's something like 70-something percent of acts of domestic terrorism come from neo-Nazis and white supremacists, and it's something like 20-something percent from the people that we have most of our focus on, which is the idea of Islamic terrorists coming in being somehow part of the Muslim community in this country?
Well, there's some definitional issues in those statistics, and also different studies and different people count things different ways. I don't like to get into a competition of what is the bigger or biggest problem. We definitely have two sources of homegrown terrorism here in the U.S. One, as you mentioned, is people inspired by the message of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Of course, various strands of falls under the umbrella of right-wing extremism, but that can include white supremacists, neo-Nazis, militia groups, property rights groups, anti-Muslim, anti-Islam. So there are a variety of strands. You know, by my count, in terms of looking at homicides since 9/11, the two forms of terrorism that I mentioned are, fairly comparable in the amount of damage that they have done in terms of, actual acts of violence. If you look at the number of perpetrators or the number of casualties, you can kind of come up with a little bit different statistics. But I think the two problems are fairly comparable. But you're right that the lion's share of the attention resources have gone towards trying to prevent acts of terrorism inspired by Al-Qaeda or ISIS here in the U.S.
And has this not changed pretty radically under the Trump administration with the influence of Sebastian Gorka and his wife, Catherine, who is a consultant to the Department of Homeland Security?
Well, not being inside the department, I couldn't tell you who is influencing what. And also, I have to say, the Obama administration didn't really apply tremendous levels of resources to dealing with the right-wing extremism problem either. In terms of the so-called Countering Violent Extremism Initiative that began in 2011, was focused mainly at doing outreach, engagement, and programming with Muslim communities. There was some effort towards different forms of right-wing extremism, but that wasn't the focus of the program. In terms of the FBI's level of effort and focus under the Obama administration, vastly greater resources were dedicated towards the Al-Qaeda slash ISIS problem. So I wouldn't say that when the Trump administration came in, there was really, let's say, even a 50-50 or maybe even a 25-75 split. But certainly the rhetoric of this administration has shifted dramatically. It doesn't even pretend that the preventative efforts are directed at both forms of extremism. And as I'm sure we're going to get into, some of the programmatic decisions that have been made are tilting the field even further away from dealing with right-wing extremism.
So what is your analysis of why the president sort of uses this kind of equal time, this sort of idea of fair and balanced, to quote Fox News? In other words, he keeps insisting against all evidence, particularly if you look at I don't know whether you saw the Vice News video of Charlottesville, but it's pretty shocking to hear from the neo-Nazis themselves that somehow the president keeps insisting that there are fine people on both sides, and that the blame can be equally apportioned, even though it's pretty clear that a young woman was murdered by a neo-Nazi in plain sight, running down and injuring 19 others with his car, which is a subject we'll discuss in the next segment with Mia Bloom, comparing what happened in Charlottesville to what happened in Barcelona. So do you have an explanation for that? And is that the influence of Gorka or somebody inside the administration, or are these Trump's own peculiar beliefs?
Well, I think in the end, the words that come out of the president's mouth or the tweets that he posts himself really have to be attributed, you know, not to secret staffers. I doubt that Mr. Gorka gets much FaceTime with the president. I think it really has to goes to the mindset of the president himself. I don't like to gauge in armchair psychology, but there's certainly no shortage of that going on. To me, the president has a Jewish son-in-law. His daughter has converted. He certainly doesn't. He has lots of associates who are Jewish. He's appointed Jews to high places within his White House. I don't think he sees himself as anti-Semitic, but it is difficult to square that, for example, with his failure to condemn blatantly anti-Semitic neo-Nazi statements emanating from Charlottesville. Similarly, on the racism side, he certainly would like to believe that he doesn't harbor racial animus. He believes he treats people equally on the basis of race. He associates himself. He's appointed African-Americans to his cabinet. So he certainly doesn't perceive himself as racist, but it's really incomprehensible to really understand why he doesn't condemn blatant or equivocates on condemning blatant racism that we've seen in our streets. I do think he is a very insecure president. He doesn't like to criticize people who support him and his views, and he tries to find ways to justify their actions because he's so fixated on his own self-image, and I think that's one of the explanations for why he, won't condemn these individuals who are otherwise lauding him with praise. He likes people who praise him. And so he doesn't want to criticize them. So he makes these bizarre, ridiculous equivocations on, things that any other president would have, from their heart, would have quickly and easily condemned. And then every time Trump is speaking his own mind, without a script, it's clear he can't get himself to do it.
And again, I'm speaking with David Shanzer, Professor of the Practice of and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as counsel to Senator Joseph Biden and counsel to Senator William Cohen, and worked in the executive branch as special counsel to the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Defense and as a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. But just in terms of what happened yesterday in Boston, where 40,000 people, overwhelmingly peaceful marchers, marched, and there were something like about 100 neo-Nazis corralled in a little kind of coliseum type situation in the middle of a park. So. And the president, for reasons that, again, mystify me, tweeted out in terms of the 40,000 largely peaceful demonstrators, I think about 30 people were arrested. So you compare 30 to 40,000. The president, nevertheless, tweets out, looks like many anti-police agitators in Boston. So he continues to do this. It's very strange.
Yes, I don't have a PhD in psychology. I certainly have read other people who do that, talk about paranoia and fear of enemies. And he does seem to see enemies around every corner. One thing I'd like to say about Boston, and I did some interviews right after the Charlottesville, and I feel like this is the right response, is to, don't get in these people's faces and don't don't engage in violent action with them because the white supremacists, because you know that feeds into their narrative. They want to feel like they are fighting for a particular way of life, that they're you know being oppressed by you know this diverse group of people, the New America, young people, minorities, and so on. They want to feel like they're fighting against oppression against them. But you know, to overwhelm them and just to show that you know, by two or more orders of magnitude, this is a fringe element in American society. They're there. There's no doubt. They have friends in high places. That is true currently. But you know, the vast number of Americans reject these notions of racial inequality, of anti-Semitism, of blatant homophobia, and I think whenever they jump, you know, the people who feel this way about American values, you know, in Michelle Obama's words, should jump twice as high. But staying away from lawlessness and violence is definitely the way to go, and I think the way to confront this movement in America.
Well, but do you see this movement gaining strength? Because my sense is that one of the things that drives this white supremacist movement is this insecurity amongst white men that they're an endangered species, that demographics are against them, and that they're going to be living in a majority brown and black country in a matter of a decade or so. And if that's the case, then things are just going to get worse for them as they become more and more you know, marginalized in their own minds.
Well, I think I think our policies, you know, ought to, you know, reflect some of the insecurities that might be breeding this, and that's not to sympathize with white supremacy at all. But I'm sure, you know, if you've read, and I've been recently reading Hillbilly Elegy, and we know about the opioid crisis and crisis in many of our, you know, white lower middle class or white poor places around America. And, you know, our policymakers need to understand that. That doesn't mean stopping policies that create fairness and enforcement of civil rights or placating white supremacists. But, you know, we should try to address the economic fears that they're facing due to globalization, mechanization, like your prior guest was talking about. So those things can help take some of the steam out of a possible move towards extremism and violence. And also, let's understand that these undercurrents have been in American society, you know, not just in the last week or not since just since the Charleston shooting, but, you know, they've been undercurrents for many, many decades, even well before Jim Crow and civil rights. They have, you know, been out of fashion and suppressed. Obviously, the rise of Trump has emboldened them and therefore makes it seem like they're more powerful and there are more of them out there. That might be true to some extent. I don't expect this fringe movement to be snuffed out in the decades as America continues to become more diverse demographically. But I'd also don't expect them to become politically very powerful. I don't expect masses levels of violence because, you know, no, in these fringe movements, even if they are willing to go out and protest, you know, only small numbers of people, even within the movements, are willing to put their own life at risk and kill others, like the perpetrator did in Charlottesville last weekend. So I don't see massive waves of right-wing related violence in our immediate future.
So don't see, for example, Stephen Bannon, who just quit the White House and returned to Breitbart and made this very defiant statement that he now has his hands back on his weapons and he's going to war. And war is often used as a sort of metaphor. And they talk about this kind of Marxist liberal establishment and these globalists, et cetera, that they're against. That certainly suggests to me that Bannon and company going to be inflaming this divide? I mean, the main criticism one hears lately of President Trump is that all previous presidents, when we have these massive tragedies like we did at the AME Church in Charleston, et cetera, that presidents go on TV and try to heal the nation, whereas Donald Trump is dividing the nation. So do you think that Stephen Bannon will be dividing it even further?
Well, I agree with you. He's a flamethrower, and he's demonstrated really in the past 7 months that he's much better at tearing things apart, dividing people, than putting forward a agenda that is supported by, can get a support in the majority of a Congress, even a Congress that has a majority, Republican majorities in both houses and in the White House. So, individuals certainly have the ability to inflame, have a lot of rhetoric, do things on the internet, and there's no doubt that that can stir in some individuals a greater likelihood to radicalize them, even to the extent of engaging in violence. But I just think there's going to be a massive pushback to that. There's going to be a pushback through law enforcement efforts, though if it gets to more incidents, legislative efforts. I don't think this era of Trump can last forever. And you were asking about long-term trends before. So, in the short run, could there be more incidents inflamed by Bannon and his movement? Sure. But I for every action, there's an equal and opposite. And I expect in this instance an unequal opposite reaction. And that is that, this is the 21st century, and the vast majority of Americans are living in that century, including our elected representatives at the federal and especially at the state and the local levels, and they're just not going to tolerate that kind of outbreaks of overtly racist anti-Semitic violence. And, there'll be a strong reaction, and that can tamp it down.
Well, David Chancellor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Chancellor, who's Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, and previously was the Democratic Staff Director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as counsel to Senator Joseph Biden and counsel to Senator William Cohen, and worked in the executive branch as a special counsel to the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Defense and as a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break. We're looking into the different approach Spanish authorities take towards their Muslim communities as opposed to the Trump administration's demonization of whole communities. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mia Bloom, a professor in the communications, a professor of communications at Georgia State University. She has an advanced degree in both Arab and Russian studies and speaks 8 languages. And she's the author of the critically acclaimed book Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. And she's the author of Bombshell, Women and Terror, and the forthcoming book Small Arms, Children and Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mia Bloom.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Mia, this one of the terrorists suspects in the Barcelona massacre is 17 years old, Musa Ukabir. He, of course, was fatally shot by the police in Friday in a vehicle. I believe, I think they were all in that Audi, and they were taunting the police who'd surrounded the car, and they had these fake suicide vests on, and the police, I think, decided to shoot them. I think that's my understanding. You may know more than I do on that. But a lot of, in the Spanish press, there's a lot of speculation, and particularly amongst the Muslim community and people that knew this group of young terrorist suspects, mostly Moroccan, that there's a brains trust somewhere. There's somebody else that's brainwashing them. What's your take on that?
Well, that's what the members of their family have been saying. These dozen boys, they're all between the ages of about 17 and 22, and they were all friends. There were four sets of brothers or cousins. If you look at the information coming from the Spanish police, you see that there were three members of the exact same family, of the Alaa family, ranging, actually, I think the oldest might have been 27, and then all the way down to in the early 20s. So you've got two Ukabirs, you've got three Alaas, you've got two Abayakubs. In other words, these are all not just friends, but they're members of the same family. And so when their families have been interviewed in where they're from, you know, in Ripoli, the members of the family said they had to have come under the influence or brainwashed by some external source. And they're blaming a cleric who hasn't been named, a visiting cleric who might have radicalized them. But this is clear that they were radicalized, their behavior changed. But, you know, this is how these recruiters get their hooks into what Mark Sageman has often referred to as groups of guys, that they're vulnerable, they're easily swayed. And he clearly, you know, this cleric, if he was responsible for the brainwashing, was very effective because they managed to put together a fairly elaborate plot quickly.
Well, you know, I'd hazard a guess that it might well be a Wahhabi cleric. This is the surreal nature of what's going on internationally. There's the influence of the Saudi Arabian brand of Islam, Wahhabism. It's happened already, we know, in Bosnia, and it happened, I believe, in Belgium, did it not? That those involved in the terrorist attacks in Paris were radicalized in a mosque in Belgium. So,
I think you're absolutely right. I was at the Alcano Institute in Madrid just a few months ago, and my colleague, who's a specialist on jihadi terrorism in Spain, Carola Garcia Calvo, basically was saying that there's only been 178 foreign fighters, Spanish foreign fighters that went to ISIS. Yet she has tracked this Wahhabi influence of money coming in from the Gulf and from the Saudis for at least a decade. And so the Wahhabi influence has been very negative. What it has done is it has created a background effect in which these other jihadi interpretations are ripe for the picking. In other words, it's a very welcoming environment for radicalization because these Wahhabi clerics have laid the groundwork.
Well, but, you know, Saudi Arabia, they laid out the red carpet for Donald Trump. They flattered him, and he loved it. He did the sword dance. Jared has apparently become best friends with the young crown prince, the so-called boy king, MBS. And MBS gave Ivanka Trump $100 million for her foundation. So is this a blindness? I mean, I want to talk to you about we were talking with David Shantra about this kind of willful blindness, about how we're not dealing with white homegrown, white supremacy in terrorism here in this country, and focusing disproportionately on so-called Islamic terrorism. But just to touch on that subject matter, is that also, do you think, blinding us at a do you think in any of these discussions that American presidents have with the Saudi king that they ever say, how come all you guys that do all the terrorism, including 9/11, are influenced by your Wahhabi preachers?
No, absolutely. And I've been very vocal about the Saudis. You know, the fact is ISIS was using, until they started creating their own textbooks, they were just using Saudi textbooks to brainwash the kids. And when you look at the number of people who have been beheaded or killed by ISIS, the Saudis actually have killed and beheaded more, including homosexuals or, you know, pro-democracy or anyone that they find to be an enemy of the state. So I've not been particularly warm to Saudi Arabia as being at the forefront of fighting terrorism, precisely because when you look at the 19 hijackers, there's a lot of Saudis in that group, not to mention bin Laden's coming from Saudi Arabia. And money continued to flow to these jihadi groups until Saudi Arabia became the target of Al-Qaeda. Before that, before Khobar Towers, the Saudis were, you know, turning a blind eye if princes or princesses or, you know, members of the royal family behind the scenes continued to fund. And I'm very circumspect. I think that the Saudis really need to step up and look inwardly at what they've done to contribute to this environment in which jihadi terrorism has flourished.
Now, in terms of the symmetry that's obvious between Charlottesville and Barcelona in terms of the use of a vehicle as a weapon of mass destruction, when asked last Tuesday in that peculiar press conference that Donald Trump held in Trump Tower, he was asked by journalists, you know, about whether or not the use of that car that killed Heather Heyer and wounded 19 others in Charlottesville was an act of terrorism. And the president says, well, I think the driver of the car is a disgrace to himself, his family, and this country. And this, that is, you can call it terrorism, you can call it murder, you can call it whatever you want. What would you call it, Mia?
It was absolutely terrorism. I sat on a panel with a colleague of mine from Norwich University, William Morris, and he compares the extreme right wing with ISIS. And they learn from each other. I mean, we've known for decades that the terrorist organizations copycat each other's tactics, and they use some of the same imagery and some of the same memes. If you take a car and you have some sort of ideology behind you and you plow it into a group of civilians, it's terrorism. I don't care what the ideology is, but that's the definition of terrorism. You know, the deliberate targeting of civilians in order to spread a message because there's some sort of ideology behind that message. Barring that, then you're just looking at, you know, mass casualty attacks where someone might be crazy. Now, by and large, you can have some overlap, but if it's terrorism, it's terrorism. If someone blows up civilians, it's terrorism. I don't care what color their skin is and what religion that they practice. That's one of the reasons I started when I wrote Dying to Kill, which was about suicide terrorism. I looked at the intersection of religion and violence in every religion. And the fact is, no religion is immune. But in some religions, this violent approach to justifying the use of terrorism has flourished in ways that you don't see it in every religion, thank goodness.
So let's turn to the different approaches of the Spanish and the United States. Of course, most of these young terrorists or suspects, I suppose, but it's pretty clear that they were involved. I mean, I don't know whether you've seen the pictures of the enormous number of gas canisters they collected. They were going to do some serious damage, and obviously the house that they were preparing these explosives in blew up. They had to improvise by renting the van. But the Spanish do pretty well, as far as I know. First of all, you got Morocco right next door. You got a big diaspora, Muslim diaspora there. By and large, these communities are very cooperative with the police. And my understanding is that Donald Trump and his administration are really taking the most counterintuitive approach to combating what they call Islamic terrorism by essentially, we know he demonized the entire Hispanic community out of the gate when he first announced his presidency, and that's had an effect, my understanding is. I don't know whether you noticed he went recently, spoke to a bunch of police up in Suffolk County, New York, where he made that those remarks about don't be so nice to the suspects, you know, that was pretty appalling. But he also the whole point of that was to go after MS-13. Well, that evening on one of the TV networks, I saw an interview with a disguised member of MS-13 saying that Donald Trump has been the greatest gift to MS-13 because now the Latino communities no longer cooperate with the police and will identify them. So therefore, they got a free run. So that's an example to me of an incredibly counterintuitive approach. If you demonize communities, particularly a Muslim community, how are you going to get them to cooperate to identify people inside their community who appear to be becoming radicalized?
It's absolutely the case that the approach that the current administration has had, because of the influence of people like Steve Bannon or Miller or the two Gorkhas, has been very negative in terms of all of the inroads that had been made in the last 12 years, not even the last 8 years, to Muslim communities in order to combat violent extremism and prevent attacks in the United States. We know from studies of lone actors that there is a huge bystander effect, the way there would be, as you described in Los Angeles with MS-13, that people, you know, generally don't want to come forward. And so what CV had been doing was trying to enlist the communities to come forward, feel secure enough to call the police or call the FBI in order to prevent things from happening. And in the United States, compared to Europe, we were fairly lucky. But I think that depending on who you speak to with regard to how Spanish policy has been with regard to assimilation, I didn't get the impression being in Spain, and I spent about a week there traveling through the country doing briefings for counterterrorism. I did meet members of the Muslim community, and they actually did feel that they weren't being treated in the manner in which they liked. They felt that their names were negative on job applications or applications for university, that there was discrimination. And in fact, in the aftermath of the attack in Barcelona, there have been graffiti moors out on different mosques. Although from Ripoli, the town where all the boys are from, they actually came out with a statement saying that they would not allow that to happen in Ripoli. They didn't want the backlash. But I don't think that we can look at the United States as being by itself. I think that a lot of the European countries have either taken advantage of Muslim labor since World War II, haven't given the same rights. We see a disproportionate number of Muslims, whether it's in France or Germany, to a lesser extent Spain, in the jails. And so I don't want to make the claim that Spain was idyllic for Muslim assimilation. Now, when we're talking about the United States, up until Donald Trump, Muslim Americans, especially in California, have assimilated very well, very successful, higher than average GDP. More Muslims have university degrees than any other group. And so American Muslims have been hugely successful and have prevented so many things from ever happening on American soil or happening again after 9/11. And we owe them this great debt of being, you know, our first line of defense. My worry has been that with the policies enacted, whether it's the Muslim ban or other ridiculous statements being made, for example, by this moron Sebastian Gorka, that the only terrorism is Islamic terrorism, that in the end, we are going to turn our Muslim communities into the situation we see in Europe or in the UK, where they don't want to call the police and they don't trust the authorities and they just, you know, won't come forward.
Well, Mia Bloom, I thank you very much for joining us. Let's stay in touch, and I hope your prediction doesn't turn out to be true, but it does seem to be the direction we're heading in, and I thank you.
Well, I hope so, too, and I hope that Muslim communities always feel that they are American. When they're American Muslim, they're Americans, and many of us know that.
And again, I've been speaking with Mia Bloom, Professor of Communications at Georgia State University. She has advanced degrees in both Arab and Russian studies and speaks 8 languages and is the author of the critically acclaimed book Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. And her forthcoming book is Small Arms, Children and Terror. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.